but we are always given to, you know, enhancing a story or embellishments. There's the cliche I'm sure I've heard. Well, we're going to win. And then I looked in the corner as a guy pulled out a revolver under his jacket. And I've heard that 1,000 times. I've never seen it happen in my lifetime. So do those things happen? I'm sure they did. But I think there's been more tales of it happening. Look, the most notorious in history of boxing is the Sonny Liston Ali rematch in Lewiston. And everybody's got an opinion. I said, that's the Kennedy assassination of boxing. That's like the great question. What happened there? And everybody's opinion is different. I'm walking around looking, and I get up to the ringside, like right by the ring, and I'm looking, and I see Parnassus coming down the aisle. I said, Mr. Parnassus, I have this badge. I'm sorry to bother you. Where's my seat? And he takes a folding chair, and that's just the ring, right at the ring. Annapolis is my idol. Remember this, I'm 17. He takes his folding chair. He says, here's your seat. He puts the chair right on the ring. There's your seat. I said, I fill up with tears even now. And then they said, 15 round, Jose Annapolis, Ernie Red Lopez. I said, holy cow. Front row, my idol's fighting. This is it for me. King says, come on back. I hired you, not them. You're working for me. I said, no, you got to fire them. He said, well, I'm not firing them and I'm not firing you. So if you want to come back with them, you can. If you don't, you know, I'm not firing them. But I'm telling you, you can come back.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebump to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's bitten me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
I'm absolutely thrilled to bring you this conversation with matchmaker and agent and boxing historian Don Majeski. Don is, you know what, they talk about a lot of lost arts in boxing. They talk about the lost art of teaching. They talk about the lost arts of the jab and loads of different things. Well, one of the arts we're losing, I think, seriously, is the art of storytelling. And there probably isn't a better storyteller around than Don Majeski. Don has been around since the mid-60s, really, growing up in New York, watching the likes of Dick Tiger, Bob Foster, and many more coming through. He was at the fight of the century between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in 1971. He was even in Zaire in 1974 for Ali's fight with Big George Foreman. He worked then as a journalist, writing for Flash Gordon's newsletter, the controversial newsletter, which we talk about here, and writing for Boxing Illustrated. Over the years, he's become more intrinsically linked to various fighters, promoters, and managers. But as I said, the key to Don is in the storytelling, and I absolutely love this. We could have gone on and on and on, but I'd very much like to do a part two in person down the line. I really hope that you enjoy this as much as I did. This is a proper boxing, like a rollicking boxing tale. So many good things in here. And I hope you get as much of a kick out of it as I did. Before I bring you to Don, a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And now here's the brilliant Don Majeski. So, Don, let me start by asking you this. You've had a lifetime in the sport. Were your parents into boxing at all?
Absolutely not. My dad predeceased me. He passed away in September. I was born in October. So my mom raised me with my maternal grandparents. No interest in sport on my mother's father and mother's side. My mother, you know, she didn't really have it. Boxing was so alien. I wanted to be a zoologist when I was a kid. My family's background, my mother's side, my name's Majeski. My father was a Polish-American, third generation. But my mother's side, her dad was named Armstrong. And they came to North America in 1719. So they were absolutely, you know, no boxing, none of that immigrant experience to be involved. When I said I was going to the boxing rather than zoology, they really thought I was crazy, quite frankly. They just couldn't understand it. They didn't know where the interest came from or whatever.
Did you have a paternal role model with your dad not being around?
Yeah, I had a friend of my mom's was there. And that's it. My grandfather, of course, I had two grandfathers still living. So they were. But as I said, none of them ever expressed any interest in boxing. I found out later that I had an uncle who liked boxing, but that was after I got involved with writing and a little bit more into the business. But the first experience I had was listening. There was a television show called Wonderama, which would come on Sunday afternoons for about 3 hours with kids. They didn't have different celebrities on. They play games. It's kind of audience participation in those early days, the late 50s and 60s. And there was a the guy who was the host was a fellow named Sandy Fox. And at night one time, he was doing a show on Joe Louis. And I just happened to come across that. And I was figuring it was going to be a cartoon show or something like that. So I was exposed to Joe Louis. And then in 64, I remember very well listening to clock radio in my mother's bedroom of the Clay then Liston fight in Miami, 1964. And I had sort of followed Liston a little bit at that time. It saw you'd go to a movie theater. And when you go to see a movie, before the movie would start, they have like a newsreel. They had the clips of the they'd replay these fights that would be on closed circuit, let's say. And the next weekend, they'd have them in the theater, maybe four or five rounds of it. And so I got to see Liston and Patterson. And then I caught my attention, and I remember listening to Clay Liston, thing that Liston, of course, was going to annihilate him. Showed I probably knew as little then as I know now, but that he won, and that was it. And then started a little bit of interest after that.
What was, you know, being that age, young and impressionable, you must have subscribed to the thought that Sonny Liston was a complete ogre.
Oh, yes, he was a monster. I mean, you heard him, everything they said. And as I said, the first impression I had of Liston was in the newsreel, him knocking out Patterson. I think it was the rematch in Las Vegas. And all you read about, of course, in the newspapers at the time, how he was going to destroy Clay and he was going to be champion for 10 years. I mean, people forget today how impressive Liston's reputation was at the time. He was like the coming Joe Louis. The analogy I can make is I remember when sort of Foreman, when he came along, knocked out Frazier, the understanding that he was going to be champ for 10 years. I remember inaccurately writing that this is the Sonny Liston who would have been champ had he won the title at 23 or 24. Of course, he again also lost to Ali. So it was sort of followed my formula, picking against Ali and always being wrong.
So where were you brought up? Were you in Manhattan?
No, we were in Queens, which is, you know, New York consists of five boroughs. There's Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx, quick geography, that's Staten Island. So most native New Yorkers, what they would have done, like my grandparents did, they would have been born and raised in Manhattan, and then they had a family that would move out to Queens. So New York is large enough that we have our own suburbs. So Queens is the working class kind of a place, a little bit higher than Brooklyn in the estimation of people who lived here. It was attached. We're on Long Island, which is an island, geographically speaking, or geologically speaking. We're the northeast quadrant. Brooklyn is the northwest. Brooklyn is southwest. And then you go further east, you go to Nassau and Suffolk. A lot of British names in New York, of course, right? We're New York. And so we went, that's where the working class people would have gone, or lower middle class people. And then Brooklyn were pretty much people unto themselves. But the idea of New York is always Manhattan, big buildings. But where I live, you know, you have single family homes and a lawn, small lawn, and what you would think is a suburbia, an early suburbia. Then that expanded to further out in Long Island after World War II.
Were you a fan of all sports?
No, I wasn't a boxing fan. I wanted to be a zoologist. My mother and would insist my grandma's take me to the zoo, the aquarium. And my mom, fortunately, worked for American Airlines. So we would get to travel what they call non-rev. You could travel around the country and later around the world. So we got to go to California or in Texas and Arizona, places like that on vacations. And just the zoo, boxing and sports. My grandmother's brother was a great fan of the New York Giants baseball team. They moved to California in 58, became the San Francisco Giants, along with the Dodgers, who left Brooklyn and moved to L.A. in 58 and here, the L.A. Dodgers. And we, of course, always had the Yankees, which is the great baseball team of Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle. But, you know, incidentally, I started following baseball, I guess, because of the uncle took me to a game when the Giants were playing. I was a little boy, couldn't remember much. And then a little later in the 60s, what piqued the interest was when Roger Maris was a ball player and Babe Ruth was the great hero. And he had hit 60 home runs, which is a great achievement. And Maris was chasing that. That was on all the stations, big story. So probably 61. But then we became Yankee fans, friends of the Mets, played here in Queens. So, of course, that's the hometown team. Of course, they were abominable, so it was hard to follow a team always losing. But, yeah, little by little, baseball and boxing. And because baseball and boxing have such great historic roots and such great traditions in American sport, that the historical interest sort of piqued my attention.
Well, that was one of my questions. Obviously, boxing was New York was a hub for boxing back then. So in the gyms and obviously at the Garden. So were you going to gyms and were you going to fights before you were actually working in the business? Were you going to the garden and stuff?
Yeah, the first time, as I said, I listened to the Clay then list. I'm not using it to disparage Ali, but that's what his name was at the time. I'd ask you, when you write about him in the early 60s, do you use Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali? Because do we retroactively call him Muhammad Ali when he had that name and then later changed it? Is it more historically accurate, say, Cassius Clay Liston fight than Ali Liston? Because at the time, that's who he was. Anyway, that's another discussion. But I started following it. What happened is after that fight, they had a show called Why World of Sports. And on Saturday afternoon, rather going to the movie theater, they would replay these big fights that were on Closed Circuit. So the Ali Liston and then the Ali Patterson fights I would see on the Saturday afternoon. And then they started on Bob Arum, actually came into the business soon after that and did the Ali Chavala fight in Toronto in 66. And they started the first televised heavyweight champion fight in about a decade. They came with the Telstar satellite. Actually, it was out of Britain when Ali came and fought Henry Cooper there in the rematch. Then he fought Brian London. So I saw that fight in the afternoon. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Ali and Cooper. And at night, we had a fight at Shea Stadium, the baseball park, the new ballpark they built for the Mets. And it was Jose Torres and Wayne Thornton. And I insisted my mom take me to go see that. But in New York, you had to be 14 years of age to go. So I almost couldn't get in. I had to my mother insist that to take me in there at 14. And we sat way up in the upper stands. There were about 5,000 people there, which should have told me it's not a great business to go in a 50,000 seat stadium. And then Torres won. He handily beat Wayne Thornton, who was from California, an Irish kid, Irish American. And then after that, I became a fan. I started following it. In those days, we had the newspapers, which would have a regular boxing writer. And there was one, Lester Bromberg. He would write a column on a Monday. And a fellow, Marshall Reed, would write every Thursday. So you could follow boxing. Ben Green had a column every Sunday in the Sports Eye. So if you want to just follow boxing, you could read about it. And they had the little tidbits. Now, this fight is going to be made. That guy's in training. So-and-so. So like gossip columns, as well as the regular coverage of fights. So then I started following boxing on a regular basis. And they had a weekly card at the Maritime Union Hall, which was on 14th Street and 8th Avenue. And I would go there every week. And then I remember seeing Ali and Zora Foley in the Garden. That was March of 67. Then Frazier fought Chavalo in July. And then I was pretty much a hardcore boxing fan, still going to high school at the time and following boxing, buying the Boxing Illustrated and the Ring magazine, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you see Bob Foster there?
Oh, yes. I saw Foster when he won the title May of 1968 against Dick Tiger. Yeah, fantastic knockout power. I remember you would follow them. You follow their career like the Ring. Had that agate type. So when they were coming up, they'd read about results. He was boxing out of Washington, D.C. at the time. So I remember clearly, and we became good friends later. I actually moved to Albuquerque for about a year. His trainer, Billy Edwards, was one of my best friends, a wonderful guy. And Foster, I knew him late in his career, but phenomenal puncher. Great, one of the greatest fighters I've ever lived.
I mean, if you saw that knockout in 1968, you could stay in your you could have stayed in boxing for the remainder of your life and not seen a better punch.
No, that's right. Those certain things that stay with you. And Dick Tiger, I'll tell you, I actually thought he was dead. You know, Tiger, I think he'd been stopped on a cut early in his career, but never knocked out. And this is the durability of Tiger. And you saw that granitic kind of, he was shaped like a rock, Dick Tiger, a perfect build, perfect physique. And just Foster leaned in. He had that long left jab and he hooked off the jab and then left and a right and bang. Tiger went down. It was as if he was shot and just laid there for about 15, 20 seconds.
There was a story that Bob leveled a fan up at Graziano's in the Canastota who once went and challenged him and said that Michael Spinks would have kicked his ass.
But Bob was quite, very, very protective of his record. You know, I remember him lashing out on Virgil Hill when he brought the record and said, oh, he didn't fight anybody. But I think he was capable of that. You know, became a deputy sheriff in Albuquerque. And he was a very plain kind of a guy, you know, very accessible. But don't taunt him on his ability or on his accomplishments. He would challenge anybody for that.
Why didn't he cut a heavyweight? Was it just a size thing?
You know, I just think the way he was, it's sort of like when Arguello moved up and boxed Aaron Pryor. There was just the physique. He had tremendous power. And remember, he didn't cut it with heavyweights against the best heavyweights of all time. He lost, obviously, to Ali. He lost to Frazier. Ernie Terrell, Doug Jones, Zora Foley. I mean, these guys beat almost every other heavyweight contender. The lesser guys like Willie Besmanoff and Dave Bailey, he was able to handle. But I think it was just too much of a jump for him. You know, he was never really overweight. I mean, if he walked around 185 pounds, that was a lot. He was a real natural light heavyweight.
And 50 years ago this year, you were actually at the fight of the century, weren't you? Between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in their first fight.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, but that was brought up a couple of discussions this year. That was still, again, 50 years later, I've said it's really, it was the most memorable experience I've had in boxing. Other than, you know, personal things where you work with a fighter and they win a championship for people you've known. But for one incident, I think that sort of defined my generation of boxing fans. It was incredible. And I was a Joe Frazier fan at that time as well.
With all due respect, if so many celebrities couldn't get a ticket, how did you get a ticket?
Well, the story is that, I was working for a guy. We had this guy, Malcolm Flash Gordon, sort of like an underground legend in boxing. And Johnny Boz, who was a big agent later, he worked with Mickey Duff all through his life. And we used to write a program that would be done on an offset machine. I'll say how far back I go. And he printed in his one room apartment. And then we'd write little stories and we'd sell them outside of Madison Square Garden. It's 35 cents. And you'd get 15 cents for the program. So you sold 300, you'd have $45 and enough left to buy a ticket and get a hot dog and a Coke and go home. It was like heaven. But with that fight, everything was sold out quickly. And there was a guy who was an old bookmaker. His name was Mike Wool. We called him English because he was originally from England. He worked in the garment district. And I couldn't get a ticket, obviously. I called all the connections. I was very close to George Parnassus, who obviously knew Jack Kent Cook, who owned the Forum in L.A. where Parnassus promoted. Couldn't get a ticket. The Garden had no tickets left. And he said, I'll get you one. So there was a fella, Billy Brown, who used to be the matchmaker at Madison Square Garden in the 40s and 50s. His brother ran a ticket agency at the now defunct Abbey Victoria Hotel. So he said, I'll get you a ticket. And the cheapest...
Shabby Abbey.
That's right. Infamous. That's what all the boxing people used to say for like $20 a night, you know, with the rate. I think it was 17 with the rate. But he said, I'll get you a ticket. And it was $20 with the cheapest seats. That's way up in the upper balcony. And he said, it's $35. Well, in 1971, $35. I said, all right. And I debated back and forth. Said, no, I got to buy a ticket. So I went for the $35. And I always have buyer's remorse. But that time, after I bought it, I didn't have any more remorse. So I got it and nestled up there in the balcony, the upper level in the Eagle's Nest. And then sort of wormed my way down as you did as a kid and to get a better seat. And you give the usher another $5 or $10 and sit on the stairs. And as I said, the story I've told is that I was on the stairs and sitting in front of me in a regular seat was Aretha Franklin with this huge conical hat on. I don't know what it looked like, something out of the Renaissance paintings you see. And I remember clearly this guy sitting behind her, because I've told the story multiple times, you know, yelling, take off that hat, take off that hat. And his friends nudged him. He said, look, that's Aretha Franklin. He says, I don't give a damn who she is. I paid $100 for the seat. And she's going to take off that hat. She never took off the hat. So he sort of went back and forth to see her, to see the fight. But that was it. But everybody was, I came down in the freight elevator after the fight with Gene Kelly. I remember that. So that's just little things. But the fight and Dan McAlinden, who just passed away, he fought. I remember him fighting on this, what was basically the semifinal in the sixth rounder.
Yeah, he fought Rat Manali, didn't he?
Yes. Muhammad yeah, Ali. It's a bad night for the Alis. They both suffered their first defeat that night, yeah.
Sure. Tell me about, you mentioned there Malcolm Flash Gordon. Obviously, to someone like me who never met him, there's urban legend.
Yeah.
What was he like? It's almost like it's not a real person because of the moniker and everything else, but he actually existed. What was he like?
Well, you know, he's a Jewish guy from the Bronx, born in the late 40s, gnomish little guy. Maybe he's about 5'1", maybe 5'2", is on his toes. He had long hair because they all thought he was a hippie, but he actually was the antithesis of that. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. He didn't use pot. He wasn't into drugs, but he had gone to the School of Art and Design in the Bronx originally, and he split with his family, Jewish family, and then went down to Manhattan after he got out of school. He was a great artist. I mean, he was very meticulous, and his interest was primarily in trains. I guess his grandfather had some profound effect. He had something to do with the railroad. So we moved to this neighborhood, we call it, really. It's in Queens, called Sunnyside. And there was an arena there, Sunnyside Gardens, a small club arena, like York Hall, I guess it'd be comparable. And people figured he went there to go because close to the boxing ring. But actually, he went there because it's close to a railroad yard, the Long Island Railroad and the Grand Central Railroad were based. They had all their car bonds there. So we'd go down in the afternoon and sketch these trains. In this most incredibly meticulous design, we would have the railroad track with the grass growing out of it, or a mouse was running across the track, or he had the windows done in a particular thing. But rarely, if ever, do you have any people in these pictures, just the trains and the intimate detail. So he would do that. Sometimes you see him pop up on eBay on the internet. So didn't get a chance to take a look. And then he, I don't know how he got into boxing, but then he started with this program. And I met him and Johnny Boz, who actually Johnny Bosdahl, his father was Norwegian and his mother was Welsh. And a guy named Jack Obermeyer, K-O-J-O, who was also a bit of a legend. And they were, I used to write letters as a kid to Teddy Brenner, the matchmaker of Madison Square Garden. Why don't you make this match and that match? Why don't you bring in, I don't know, Jose Legra and Jose Napolis and Sugar Ramos and, you know, Horacio Acavallo, fighters we never saw. And he would write back and say, I did that. The only people in the arena would be the manager, yourself and me, and I don't pay for a ticket. But I heard them. There was a fight in 1968, what we call the Felt Forum, which was named after Irving Mitchell Felt, who was then president of the Garden, not because that plush felt seats. And Chuck Wepner was fighting Jerry Tomasetti. And Wepner had been around. You know, he was a relic even then. And, oh, my God, Wepner. I said, oh, Wepner again. And I heard these three guys commenting, oh, Wepner, why don't they bring in the same guys I was, Nicolino Loce or this one or that, Carlos Monzon, when he was just coming up. And I said, boy, this is music to my ear. And we just started a conversation and then we got hooked. And Boz said, why don't you sell a program for us and you can write and give your opinion? I said, okay. We had no editor. You could see it. There's grammatical and spelling and punctuation mistakes all over. But the opinions were strong and the passion was there. So from there, we became great friends. And then I got it. They wanted to give Flash his name. Well, Flash went after the cartoon character, just rolled in. And they wanted to give him a job at Boxing Illustrated, just being like the office boy and breaking in, clipping files, writing the covering the lower echelon fights. And he was too independent. So Gil Clancy, who was, we used to go to his gym called Telstar on 27th Street and 7th Avenue. He said, you want the job? So I said, I'll take it. And I had just gone out of high school, was going to college at night. And that didn't last long. And then they got into the job. Bert Sugar had just purchased Boxing Illustrated. Lou Eskin was the editor. And so in December 70, that was my first working job. And I went there from office boy and then stayed there. I always wanted to get into the business. But from that, I did publicity for local clubs and did a little matchmaking and then evolved into what it was. But Flash was an amazing, brilliant, great, incredible guy of the most integrity I've ever known. Unbelievable integrity. And afterwards, he started to change. He was always a very eccentric, idiosyncratic guy. But when that tournament came, the business changed, he couldn't change with it. So when he had WBA, WBC, he couldn't comprehend that. And he started to be much more hypercritical, where we used to do it sort of with a laugh and a joke. And then he got really involved and a lot of problems he had with people after that. And then eventually got out of the business and became kind of reclusive.
Jeez,
he passed away about 3-4 years ago.
God knows what you think about it today.
Oh, well, you know, today you probably have an internet site and something like that and probably be getting sued left and right. You know, he had no money, so they couldn't sue him. I mean, he would live on hand to hand or, you know, show to show and pay his rent and count it out. I remember him counting out in quarters and dimes. His rent was $67 a month. So, well, I got $65.40, $65.60, and we better sell some programs tonight. I'll pay the rest. So, but he, you know, was quite happy in what he was doing.
So when you talk about programs, you're talking about the infamous Flash Gordon newsletter, right?
That's right. Well, then it evolved. What happened is he started with the program. We would sell at the Garden, at the North Bergen Arena at Philadelphia. He became great friends with Russell Peltz, who was, again, a young Turk coming up at the time. We had a different attitude. You know, it's a funny thing with boxing in those days. There was a break. You had people like I remember meeting Nat Fleischer and Dan Daniel and Bill Daly and George Parnassus, a great mentor of mine. People who actually born in the 19th century, and then people in the early 20th century, like Harry Markson. Then you seem to have a big break. And then you had people like ourselves who were born in the 50s and 40s. Because in the middle there, the World War II years, I guess people were not making a living. So you have people with attitudes, you know, 50 to 100 years old. And then this post-Vietnam War group with a totally different attitude. So you had these iconoclasts and these classicists just smashing in together, two different worlds, you know, post-television world to the pre-movie world, basically. And so there was a big clash of ideologies there.
What were some of the early things you wrote for Flash, be it the program or the newsletter? What were some of the things that you wrote? Did you do live fight reports or do you?
Oh, well, we do fight reports. We do, you know, you'd write a column. Like I would always be, you know, I was very cliched in those days. So we'd have an Irish fighter come to New York and I write about Irish fighters. You'd have Ken Buchanan. The Ring magazine, if you go back, you can see where they did that, you know. Somebody's Ken Buchanan wins the title. So the next is a feature on, well, Benny Lynch and all the great Scott fighters, you know, and somebody from Australia wins. And the next thing they're writing a a companion piece about Les Darcy and young Griffo, you know, after Lionel Rose won the title. So those kind of things, interviews with managers, you could, and then sort of these little gossip columns, you could write little things. So-and-so's got a planned fight. So-and-so is wants to box this one and the manager challenges that one. And this is a great young fighter. He's working as a bus driver, a lathe operator, and they'd get their picture. And you could really ingratiate yourself with people like that. And everything that we did initially was very positive. But to get back to the point of Flash, so we had the program. And then he started doing yearbooks, record books. Well, he noticed that the ring record book was so full of errors, you know, forgetting about the old-time fighters, the current fighters, and they were doing a very poor job. And that Fleischer had just gotten too old, and the staff grew old. You would go up there, and it was sort of like the scene from one of these, what, Mary Poppins, where these old bankers come in there, you know, like 100 years old. You'd seen that Fleischer, which, you know, like I say, a living legend. And there he was in the flesh, but he was dressed like it was 1910 in a vest and a cap and walking around like he was there in the newsroom in 1915. And then Dan Daniel was in his 80s and Sam Taub was in his 80s. And Jersey Jones was still up there and this Ted Carroll. And these are all revered men, but this was there were nobody in their 20s or 30s coming up there. They had a guy, Johnny Ort, who was also more interested in using the ring as a vehicle for him to make money than he was. You know, there was no ideal there. He was not an idealist by any stretch of the imagination. So these records, they were not keeping them up to date. And Flash published a New York State record book and they published a U.S. record book. And that's really the first time people started paying attention to the boxing records. Before that, it was, the guy's got 50 wins or 30 wins or fighter would claim 600 victories. There was no box record or anything like that. There's no integrity. It was whatever the manager gave you. And you knew the fighters. So a record then was, who did he beat? Well, he beat Louis Rodriguez and Denny Moyer and Ralph Dupas. That's the record, not 33-0 or 36-1 or 128-4. That was sort of an arithmetical kind of a number. It was nothing that related to the real fighter. Anyhow, so he did that. And then the ring started taking exception. And then he branched out to do the program. And I said, Flash, you're doing too much. You know, he would take the profits of the selling the programs to underwrite the weekly boxing news and then go into the record book. And what finally did him in is he got himself into debt. He wanted to really publish a good book and went to a printer to do it, borrowed money from a guy. And he just didn't really had no business sense. And he didn't realize the cost of doing it. He got himself about $5,000 in debt, which would look like a million today. And he couldn't pay off the debt. And out of shame, he just sort of backed off. But when he exposed that boxing tournament, that ring tournament with the phony, falsified records and trumped up different accomplishments of fighters to get them in there because certain managers had a hook, that gave him national news. And I think something happened to him. He had I'm not a psychiatrist, but he's had some kind of a break that pushed him over the edge, too much publicity, and he couldn't handle it. And managers really coming after him. He got beat up by Patty Flood, who was a manager involved in that. And a lot of threats against him. And, this cost him real money now. It wasn't just joking around and saying things. So it sort of pushed him out of the business. But his program was a precursor to really what you would see on, Fight News, a boxing scene, or your website. He was born a little bit too early because he probably would have been really doing very well had he come into the internet days and where he could have his own website and things like that.
I mean, we segued into it briefly there, but you were coming through at a time where the IBC was kind of shutting up shop then.
Well, the IBC with Jim Norris had sort of shut down in the 60s. We sort of came, I'll tell you, I came in a wonderful period of time because what had happened there, in America, yeah, the IBC closed down about 57, 58, and then boxing went off regular network TV. We have ABC here, CBS, NBC. That would be every. At one point, we had five boxing cards on primetime television a week. It was unbelievable. The popularity wasn't popular going to the shows. It killed the clubs because people said, I can watch it on TV. I don't have to go to the arena. And what you miss then, if you're watching boxing on TV with the main event, you don't see the preliminary kids coming up. So you don't familiarize. Like I was familiar with all the young kids coming up in New York. So when they fought a main event, I already knew them. So they all had a crowd base, a fan base. And that killed that. You'd see a main event and or a walkout bout afterwards, and then you turn on to Gunsmoke or whatever else you wanted to watch. So that hurt. But so we stopped regular boxing, weekly boxing 64, which, as I said, I wasn't aware of boxing very much at that time. But what happened is after that, boxing finds a way of surviving. They went on to what we call television, where they buy up the station time. They syndicated TV. And it was a rebirth for live boxing in the arenas. I mean, the year I really became involved in 67 we had Madison Square just that one year. We had the Griffith and Joey Archer middleweight title fight. Remember, there was only one title in those days. Maybe once in a while, WBF had a split. But Griffith and Archer, the Torres-Tiger rematch, Joe Frazier against Chavallo, Ali against Foley, a non-title fight with Curtis Coates and Gypsy Joe Harris, two Griffith Benvenuti fights, one of which was in Shea Stadium, the baseball park, the Carlos Ortiz Laguna third fight, which is in the baseball park. So amazing run of fights. And California still had the Olympic going every week. And then George Parnassus came back into the business in 68. And what happened in 68? The new Madison Square Garden opened up with Frazier and Mathis and Benvenuti and Griffith, big crowd, 18,000. The Forum in L.A. opened up, giving competition to Island Inc. with George Parnassus. And he had Chucho Castillo and Jesus Pimentel. They do 18,000 people. So you have new arenas. The Spectrum in Philadelphia opened up with Frazier and then Tony Doyle. So you had a new arena in Philadelphia, a new arena in New York, a new arena in California. And this really stimulated a lot of growth. So we had a wonderful period of time between like 67 and 71, 72, where, tremendous return for boxing. So I was fortunate in that time, plus having the connection with the airlines, plus working for Bert Sugar, who would pay for us to travel around the world and see fights. You know, he's a wild man with money. So that was great. So for myself, it was a wonderful period of time. 76 changed that because we had the input of now television came back and the same kind of thing happened. People started watching it on TV, not going to the arena, and they wouldn't black out the big cities like New York and L.A. for the fight, so that hurt them. And then you had casinos coming. Casinos came in, with Jerry Parencio, where he started it with they always had fights in Vegas, but when he came with Foreman and Lyle, he got the casino to subsidize the fight with a site fee, which is something unique. And then Atlantic City opened up with casinos, and they would subsidize fights. So for a fight to draw 200,000 in Madison Square Garden, you were better off going to Atlantic City and drawing $10,000 because you could get free rooms, the meals, the RFB, we call it, room, food, and beverage, plus the arena for free, plus they pay you a fee because they would have a 2 hours on national television promoting their casino. So that really changed the face of boxing in America.
I just want to jump back to the IBC bit. Did you ever meet any of those guys, Messrs. Norris, Carbo, or Palermo?
No, I never met any of these guys. Well, Blinky Palermo got out of prison when I was young, and so did Carbo. But I saw him, but I didn't know him. I didn't familiarize myself. It's funny. I never knew of any gangsters involved. I knew people who knew gangsters, like all of the people of that generation. Cuco Condi was a great friend of Frankie Carbo. And, of course, Bill Daly knew them. And Parnassus and Teddy Brenner, they had to. They were just part of the fabric of the industry. But I personally never met them. I will say this. Everyone from that generation, Chris Dundee included, who knew these people, loathed Blinky Palermo and loved Frankie Carbo. I never heard one of them saying a bad word about Frankie Carbo. I'm not endorsing him for the Hall of Fame, by the way. But for whatever reason, they liked Frankie Carbo. Cuco Condi, I remember, had a watch that Frankie gave him. He said he was the matchmaker in Havana. He was also the maitre d' at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino, famous in Havana. And he said, Frankie called him in the room and said, Cuco, come downstairs. What is it? He said, I got something for you. He said, got something for you. Oh, God, what did I do wrong? He goes and he hands him a Bon Mercier watch with two Cuco from Frankie, friends forever. And he was so proud. He wore that watch everywhere. He showed it to me, the engraving in the back and everything else. He's thrilled.
So was Frankie was Mr. Gray. He was the king. And Blinky was like an enforcer for him, wasn't he?
I think so, yes. And Blinky, the funny thing, he was actually a licensed manager. I mean, he was licensed in Pennsylvania, licensed in New York. He had Ike Williams, most famously. And so, but Carbo never was, obviously. He was the gangster man behind the scenes. But Blinky was a front man, so he must have had enough legitimacy before he went to prison to be qualified to get a license.
Yeah, because they had Johnny Saxton, and they were involved with all those guys.
Yes, a lot of going back to Teddy Aros and, back even to the 30s, Solly Krieger. You could see this list of fighters. They said that I guess the NBA middleweight title is basically their own personal playground. But hundreds of fighters. And I've heard look, of course, nobody wants to be involved with gangsters, but people would say, look, they would go to you and say, they said more managers would go to them to say, take a piece of my fighter to move him. And it would be the other way around. They would come in and they see a fighter and they'd want to move in. But they said guys would want to be, you have a fighter making nothing. They say, take half my earnings and move the fighter for me. And so you were better off with half with them than you were 100% without them. And I mean, something like that happens in different ways. Nowadays, you go to a certain promoter. If you don't have a promoter now, you can't really have a fighter be successful. You can't do it on you. In my day, you could. This is another major change that's come about in boxing. Promotional rights change that.
You'll probably remember it more than me, but I remember speaking to Harold Johnson about the Orange fight. Do you remember that?
I remember that, reading about it. I didn't see it. What was his, what did he say? It'd be interesting to hear what his take on it was.
Well, Harold wasn't in a great state by the time I went and met him. And he was outraged when I suggested there was any kind of foul play in this fight. So there was a fight. I can't remember who was fighting. I'm not sure if you recall, but it was obviously this story that he'd been given this orange and was poisoned. Or
Julio Medeiros. I don't remember.
That's right, Medeiros. And I've heard different. I heard different gangster stories over the years. There was a good one that George Shivalo said about Ernie Terrell and the Chicago guys that he was involved with, Bernie Glickman and those guys.
Oh, Glickman, yes, yeah. Did they threaten him?
Yeah, yeah. They threatened Shivalo's manager.
Oh, Irving Ungerman, yeah.
Yeah, and Irving was one of the kingpins, wasn't he?
He was big in Toronto. He had, a chicken processing plants or things like that. He was quite a character himself, yes. But we are always given to, enhancing a story or embellishments. There's the cliche I'm sure I've heard. Well, we're going to win. And then I looked in the corner. There was a guy pulled out a revolver under his jacket. I've heard that 1,000 times. I've never seen it happen in my lifetime. So do those things happen? I'm sure they did. But I think there's been more tales of it happening. Look, the most notorious in history of boxing is the Sonny Liston Ali rematch in Lewiston. And everybody's got an opinion. I said, that's the Kennedy assassination of boxing. That's like the great question, what happened there? And everybody's opinion is different. The motivation was, I don't know. But Duran and Leonard, he quit in that fight. Now, was this a big mob thing? And everybody's always saying, the cliche, the classical definition of a dive is two people get together and they conspire and the fighter's paid money and he goes out or bets on the other fighter. But there are others, where guys just quit. I don't have it that night and they figure I'm not going to give it. But I've heard these stories about gangs. No question they did it. No question there were a lot of phony fights that went on, undoubtedly. But I think those that are ascribed to be fixed are more a fighter looking for an excuse. Liston always denied taking a dive for Ali, and nobody believed him. Jack Johnson actually wrote a letter of confession that he took a dive in the 27th round, if you can believe it, against Willard, and nobody believed that. So nobody would believe that Johnson did take a dive, and nobody would believe that Liston didn't, yet the both spoke totally opposite opinions on what they did.
But I suppose, obviously, it's not just the fighters. When you look at Tyrone Everett and Alfredo Escalera in that fight, then it looks like one of the judges was guilty of foul play and not the fighters. So obviously, and we've seen bad decisions all the way through boxing history. Maybe it's not the fighters taking a dive. It's just relying.
Well, that's it. Why fix a fighter for millions when you can fix a judge for thousands? That's sort of going, get a judge who'll look the other way. I mean, there's a lot of hometown favoritism. Look, I was involved with the Lennox Lewis and Holyfield fight, which is a notorious decision. The first one. And, everybody investigated that Eugenia Williams situation and nothing came up about it. I was very involved. I used to, give them advice and this is a good judge. It's a bit, not an honest or dishonest, but this is a judge that'll give you a square decision. If you win, you'll win. If you lose, you lose. And when we were doing that fight, I'm trying to digress so much, Tris, but
no, it's fine.
The idea was we're going to have three neutral from neutral countries. So the original judge of the WBC was Daniel Vandeville from Belgium, a great judge and still working today and a referee. They picked Stan Christodoulou, which I thought was ironic because he's really a great referee, not much of it, not noted as a judge, although he's good. But they always, in America, as they always want to put the referee in. He was the judge of WBA. And the IBF, and then finally, you lost me here. I lost myself. Yeah. The IBF, the IBF was supposed to pick a judge from out of the United States. And then the referee we agreed was Arthur Mercanti Jr. So the IBF picked Eugenia Williams and she was an American. And Frank Maloney said to me, he said, Don, if they're going to have an American, I want a British official. So that's how Larry O'Connell got the job. So there was nothing untoward about that. And then, of course, the decision came and, Larry and I can, I've known him and he was a wonderful guy and straight as an arrow. I think what happened with him is he bent over so backwards psychologically to show that he was neutral, that every close round he gave to Holyfield just to show. I think he did this subconsciously. I know there was nothing untoward through Holyfield's side, through Don King. He's always involved. So there's a question mark. Is it legitimate? He bent over backwards, I think, to show that his impartiality, and then ended up making it a draw. And most of these judges don't even know what's going on. They figure out, give out the card, they give it to the official, he gives it to the supervisor, and they never see it again. And Stanley had it for Lennox, and she had a draw, and there's big investigations. But I think really that Bobby Lee, the president of the IBF at the time, although he did later go to jail, so his credentials are questionable, just did it to do a favor to Eugenia Williams. He wanted to put a black person there. He wanted to put a black woman there, so to make some kind of a headline, which it did carry stories at the point that this is groundbreaking. And she was just incompetent. She was not up to the task. I mean, I don't know of anything that she took money, but that's, and I've seen other bad decisions and things like that. Yeah.
Flashing back further back than that, at what point did you realize that your life was going to be spent in boxing? I've seen a story about you being at the Olympic and Jose Napoles and different things.
Yeah.
Was that where the bug bit you?
Well, Jose Napoles, again, we would follow boxers in the ring, and I'm sure you probably did that when we were young. You didn't have YouTube. You didn't have the internet. You really didn't. The newspapers weren't covering, you know, results from Mexico or Argentina or, you know, Italy on the undercards, championship fights. And I remember following the careers of Jose Legra, and he had that phenomenal record, about 60 consecutive wins, and Jose Napoles and Loche. And I would just see the agate type in the ring, one. They kept winning. And I said, gee, this guy's always winning. And as I said, I would write letters to the Garden and say, why don't you bring in Napoles? Why don't you bring in Loche? And they would bring in, you know, they were using Chuck Weapon. So Napoles, like, sort of became an idol of mine, even never having seen him. Like Harry Greb, you read about it. I idolized him. How can you never saw him? Well, look at the record. And I would write a letter. I wrote a letter to his manager named Kuko Kondi, who became a great mentor, one of the finest human beings I've ever met in my life. Even George Parnassus probably helped me as much and inspired as anybody ever lived. So the quick story, and I'll try to make it as quick as possible. We went on a vacation to California in August of 69. And Ruben Olivares was fighting Lionel Rose for the bantamweight title. Olivares was the great idol at the time. Flash, who I was writing for, I said, can you write a letter to George Parnassus for me and say, my correspondent is coming out here. He's going to cover the fight. And I had a friend who worked at the Police Gazette, which was still in existence. He wrote a letter as well. He said, well, what do you want me to write? Just, okay, I'll type a letter. Of course, he was very good. He typed, looked very professional, sends a letter out there. We made a photocopy. And Xerox, you call it in those days. So I go out there. It was 69. I was 16, and I looked about 9. So I walked. I had suit and tie on, like my communion suit. And I went in, and I said, "Mr. Parnassus." And he looked up. You know, he was 70-something years of age, glasses. And I'd seen him. You know, it was like walking into Olympus. What do you want? And I said, "Well, I'm the correspondent for the Tonight's Boxing Program." We didn't have the weekly then. And he looked at the letter and looked at me. He said, "Hugh." I said, "Yeah." Well, okay, so he throws me a ticket. I go there, and I was sitting upstairs. It wasn't in the balcony. It was down, like, in the middle of the arena, about 2 levels up, a great seat. And I had binoculars, and I had a yellow notepad, and the fight starts. I mean, it was Cruz Marcano and Dwight Hawkins and one of the semifinals. A great show, and then the Olivares fight was unbelievable. You know, had these 60 knockouts or 50 knockouts, and Rose had won the title, and he was Fighter of the Year the last year. Olivares knocks him out. Place is going crazy. So anyway, I write this story, pardon me, 22 pages he gave me in the Tonight's Program. And I pull out the thesaurus, and George Parnassus' show with Olivares, the greatest, incredible, most unbelievable, finest, greatest event in the history of humanity since the unbelievable, the fantastic show, every superlative I could think of. This Parnassus, the greatest promoter I've ever lived. Olivares, the greatest fighter, and on and on. I would have got the front cover, but Rocky Marciano died in a plane crash, you know, so he put Marciano. I couldn't put it on the front, but I'll put it 22. I'll go ahead. So I sent, obviously, a copy to Parnassus. So now Napoles is fighting in February. I was still in high school. And I get it. I go, fly me out there. I'm going to California. So I went out, same thing, write a letter, go to the arena the day before Mr. Parnassus. I know you're the guy, the correspondent. So he splashes me. He throws me a credential at that time. It was handwritten. And he says, there it is. So I go to the forum. Annapolis is now my idol. I'm really excited. I said, wow, this is great. Rodrigo Valdez fought on the card. And the forum, if you've been there in L.A., you start out, it's you go down, you walk down, like the there's that arena in Las Vegas where you start at the top and you walk your way down into the you get closer to the ring, so you have to go down in like a little, like a hole almost. All right. So I start out, and I'm up at the balcony, and I said, all right, you know, this is good. show the ticket to the usher. And the usher says, no, you're next down. I said, the next one. Oh, this is good. Then the next one down. So, oh, I'm right where I was last time for Oliver. This is great. No, you're another one down. So, oh, even better. This is wonderful. So I keep going down again. I was 17, going down. And I said, well, this is, you know, almost at the ringside. This is like the Lowe's right on the side. This is like, can't imagine. Oh, this is wonderful. I'm saying to myself. So yes, I can't find it. No, further down. I said, what's this? Yes, further down. I said, well, where am I? I'm almost at the ringside. And there's the gate, you know, as you go to the ringside from the general admission seats or the regular seats. I said, no, you're there. I said, I'm on the floor. Holy cow, this is fantastic. And I'm walking around, you know, I go to the back of the arena, obviously, because it's the last seat. And they said, no, go further. So now the fights are about to start. And I'm wondering, where's this going to happen? What's going on here? I'm walking around, looking, and I get up to the ringside, like right by the ring, and I'm looking, and I see Parnassus coming down the aisle. I said, Mr. Parnassus, I have this badge. I'm sorry to bother you. Where's my seat? And he takes a folding chair, and that's just the ring, right at the ring. Annapolis is my idol. Remember this. I'm 17. He takes his folding chair. He says, here's your seat. He puts the chair right on the ring. There's your seat. I said, I fill up with tears even now. And then they said, 15-round, Jose Annapolis, Ernie Red Lopez. I said, holy cow. Front row, my idol's fighting. This is it for me. And behind me, Jim Murray, who won the Pulitzer Prize. He's sitting next to John Hall. Murray was with the LA Times, Hall with the Herald Examiner. And I hear him say, who the fuck is this kid sitting up here? And I said, I heard, I didn't react to it. But I said, this is it. I'm in this business for the duration. And that's sort of what made, that was my epiphany.
That's brilliant. So flipping back from West Coast to East Coast, go back. Tell me about Frankie DiPaola.
Oh, well, you know, when we brought up the Foster fight, you know, he was a, there's the perfect example of how boxing changed. Of course, he was a rough, tough guy. He was involved with gangsters and Gary Garofola. And I mean, a lot of these guys who
that's
were
kind of what made me think of him, to be honest. I wasn't going to ask before. But obviously, we talked a bit about the mob, and he was, you correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't he a leg breaker for them?
He was, you know, a guy would collect, I guess, for loan sharks or, you know, for gamblers and people who were bookmakers. The guy didn't pay off. He did all sorts of odd jobs, drove the car, this and that, for whatever reason. Didn't look in the trunk. But, you know, Frankie was a great popular fighter. That's what people don't, you know, he wasn't just because he was mobbed up. He was a knockout puncher, no defense. And here's a great evolution how boxing worked in those days. Foster boxed in May of 68. The semifinal was Angel Oquendo and Johnny Pearsall. And Oquendo was expected to win, but Pearsall beat him. So, you know, this Puerto Rican guy sold tickets, so they lost the edge. But because in those days, as they said, they would show a main event on TV, on syndicated TV. And if it went short, they would have a walkout bout, a 6-round walkout bout. Again, to digress again, the walkout bout for Ali Frazier was Ken Norton and Roosevelt Eddie. And Norton didn't get to fight that night. But jumping back to the Foster fight. So the walkout bout was what we call the rubber match. Frankie DiPaola and Freddie Williams. Williams was a fighter from Brooklyn. They had fought twice. DiPaola won in Jersey. Williams won in New York. So this was the rubber match. It was always a crazy fight, the knockdowns. So in the first round, DiPaola gets knocked down, to my recollection. And everybody gets up ready to leave, thinking it's over. Then DiPaola knocks him down. Everybody sits down. The second round, DePaul's on the ropes getting hammered. Everybody gets up. DePaul comes back and hammers him. Everybody sits down. And it's going to a crazy fight like this, about 3 or 4 knockdowns. Finally, DePaul, he's losing the fight. Everybody's ready to leave. He throws one punch, knocks the guy cold. So everybody left that arena talking about Frankie DePaul that night. Like they left the arena with Buchanan Laguna talking about Duran. And they say, where's this guy coming back? So they bring him back from May to July to fight Rocky Rivera, who was another brawler on his last legs, an Argentine fighter, always made great fights. He built himself into a light heavyweight, or eaten himself to a light heavyweight by then. Same kind of thing. Ismael Laguna is the main event. They're battling it out. DePaul is taking a licking. One punch knocks the guy out. Then they opened up a smaller arena in the garden with 5,000 seats, and this guy, Jimmy McDermott, they brought him down from Boston. So this was a typical Irish-Italian match. He knocks him out, and they bring into the ring. They would do these in those days. And the winner of this fight will fight Dick Tiger October 10th in the garden. Another terrific fight. DePaul is taking a licking, knocks him out with a shot. Everybody goes out. They could buy the tickets for the next show at the the box office almost as you left the arena. So they draw 10,000 people, him and Dick Tiger. It was the fight of the year, 1968. And another couple of knocks on first 4 rounds. DePaul is down. Tiger's down. DePaul is down. And then Tiger showed a little bit more. You know, he just was the better fighter. Won a 10-round decision. So afterwards, the Garden had an option on Foster. They didn't want to do the rematch with Dick Tiger because he had knocked them out. So they made up a story that Tiger was in Nigeria, couldn't get him back, and they were looking for an opponent. And it comes down, they announced that they were going to make Frank DiPaola and Bob Foster in Jersey City Armory for the World Light Heavyweight title. And Teddy Brennan, the matchmaker, was a purist. He wouldn't make the fight. And he gets a call from Irving Mitchell Felt, the owner of the Garden, or the director. He said, Teddy, I'm reading in the paper that they're going to make Foster and DePaula in Jersey City. And Brainer, you know, said, yeah, that's right. So why aren't we doing this? It's a mismatch. He said, will it make money? He said, it'll draw 18,000 people and it'll go one round. And Felt says to him, well, Teddy, we're in the business of making money. Make the match. And in a sagacious way, the fight they fought in February of 1969, the fight went one round. They drew 18,000 people. And of course, DePaula was the victim, one round knockout loser. So, but it just shows you could take from May, DePaula, complete unknown, in 6 months, because the way they built fighters in January, that he could draw 18,000 people. And within 6 months of that, he was supposed to fight the semifinal of Benvenuti and Tiger with Don Fulmer. He got killed and he was shot and killed and because his notorious lifestyle caught up with him. So he became infamous, to, unknown to famous to infamous in the course of 1 year.
Wow. And I suppose you saw a lot of a lightweight version of Duran, who you just touched upon there. I suppose you saw a lot of Duran as a lightweight.
Oh, yes. When he came into New York, you know, it's again, the evolution of boxing. When you have this, what the again, what we're losing here is the consistency. And I'm always a great critic of the losing the big arenas in the big cities. You know, major league sports are major league, but boxing, we don't have consistent shows, New York, L.A., Philly anymore. And I bring that up because when, you know, the Donato Paduano was a hot fighter. I start with another story to lead into that. And he was a welterweight from Montreal, Italian kid and very popular. And he boxes the semi. So he's winning and he gets the semifinal on the Ali Bonavena fight in the Garden, December 7th, 1970, 19,000 people. And he's expected to win. They put him in with Ken Buchanan, who just won the title in a big upset over Laguna, a New York favorite. And the guy who steals the show is Buchanan. He perfectly outboxes Paduano with boxing less than like one from the book. And everybody's talking about Buchanan, even though Ali fought the main event that night when they leave the arena. So they bring Buchanan back months later to fight the rematch with Ismael Laguna. And on the semifinal is this new hotshot, Roberto Duran. And everybody's talking about him. We've read about him. And he annihilates a Puerto Rican kid, Benny Huertas, who had won three fights in a row to qualify in 66 seconds of the first round. Well, the same thing happened. They went there for Buchanan and Laguna, but they left there talking about Duran. And all anybody wanted to see for 9 months later was the Duran and Buchanan fight. And they worked and worked and worked. And they fought in June of 72. And they fought for the, you know, for the lightweight title. And it became like a legend. You know, guys could become legends in those days because they were fighting in Madison Square Garden, historic places. And they had been built up from the one fight to the next. And they sold out the building and then he made a tremendous hit. So he was really a New York fighter. And when they had that classic, the four or five great fighters of that generation, him and Benitez and Hagler and Leonard and Hearns, he held on the New York end. He was legendary.
At what point did you go from writing about the sport and being a fan of the sport to having jobs in the sport?
Well, I was working for Boxing Illustrated. And as I said, when I worked there was a local arena called the Sunnyside Garden, and they would run shows. There was a promoter, Cuban-American promoter, Oscar Caniel, who was a great friend of this Cuco Condi from the days in Cuba. And Cuco recommended to me to him to do, you know, just the publicity, not matches. And then Al Joyner was a promoter. He used to run shows at the Audubon Ballroom, which is infamous for the place where Malcolm X was shot. And then I would do publicity with him. I'd get $20 to $30 to do publicity. And he'd work it like 50 hours a week. I keep writing those releases. And so I segued into that. But I always wanted to get into the business of boxing, but I knew nothing. And I still don't. I can say that for a matter of fact about business at all. But because you love this, what my friend Rafael Mendoza said, your problem is, Don, you love boxing more than you like money. And that's why. So you look at it as a fan. And then there was a great matchmaker as a booking agent, Dewey Fergetta. He was like the number one booking agent in the world for many years. He used to do 300 shows a year. And I was sort of like a runner, office boy for him. You know, I'd do press releases when he'd make a fight in England, send Louis Rodriguez to fight there, or somebody sending over Mickey or Jack Solomons, and I'd write a release. And then we'd get telegrams in those days. I'd go and send his telegrams out and stuff of that nature. So I started getting interested in the business. I always wanted to be a matchmaker. And then some local people would hire me to do, you know, undercard fights for them. And I guess I started booking fighters. And I'm just trying to see how I really started in the business. You know, doing a couple of closed circuit shows, then you're sort of getting in, segueing in. And Don King came along and I worked for him as a matchmaker. And so that's really big time. And then I left Don King, went out on my own, and I worked with this fighter, Bernardo Mercado, and then Marvin Camel, and then Manuel Stewart, I met him, and then I started working with Hearns early in the days and Kinty and all his fighters. And then I got a job with Butch Lewis. When Michael Spinks was starting, he hired me to work with him in Vegas. And then we got along, and I came back to New York after living in Las Vegas for a couple of years, and then hooked up with him and been in the business, you know, I guess that's 30, 40 years in my entire life.
At what stage were you with Marvin Campbell, who I love? He's one of
yes, and he's a
guys.
He's like, he reminds me of Gary Cooper. They're both from Montana. And well, again, connections make connections. I had been out in Albuquerque. I was covering a fight with Foster and Foree, and then I met a girl out there and was going to get married, and I started living out there. And at that time, Foster had moved back to Albuquerque. He was raised there, then came to D.C., was in the Air Force, and he met his trainer, Billy Edwards, who had trained him and Holly Mims, a lot of fighters around Washington. And when he was champ, Billy moved out to Albuquerque with him. And then Billy was training Foster at the time. He went up and fought in Missoula, Montana. He met a manager named Elmer Boyce who had Marvin Campbell. And he introduced me to him. He said, Don can help get your fights. And so we became friendly. I put in Tom Bethea with him the first time. And then the cruiserweight division started because Marvin was a light heavy, if you recall. He fought Saad Muhammad, a lot of light heavy.
Yeah.
So we moved into the cruiserweight division, and I was friendly with Jose Suleiman. And we were going to fight for the title. And he was number one, and they made Matei Parlov, and I remember with an Italian boxer. And I complained. I said, no, Camel's number one. So we ended up getting the first world cruiserweight title fight. He fought Parlov in split Yugoslavia. It was a notorious draw. There's a decision that went against us. And we fought a draw, but we really won the fight. We won the fans, and we came back and won the title afterwards. But I met him through his manager, Elmer Boyce.
I was going to try and be professional and keep this very straight about you and your career, but I'm actually working on a book about Saad Muhammad now.
Oh, wow. And, great guy too, yeah.
Yeah, who I knew from 2000 to 2006, really, and spent quite a lot of time with him back then. Mm-hmm. Were you involved with Marvin for those, as he was then, Matthew Franklin fights, or was that before you got on the scene?
That was before I got in the scene. It was sort of afterwards that I met him. He had had a fight on TV. Maybe it was a Saad fight because Foster, I think, boxed up in Missoula, and he had a fight. And as I said, Billy Edwards got me involved. Probably the early 70s, just after the Saad Muhammad fight. And Marvin was growing then. He was like 180 pounds. I had a little trouble making the weight. So as it's just fortuitously the cruiserweight fight. But I knew Matthew very well because he was around Philly, and we put him in a couple of fights. He came down to Australia, in fact, to work. And I put him in a fight there. And he won. I think it was a draw. He won.
Oh, did the Kevin Wagstaff fight back in
88? That's correct. Yes. Pardon?
Back in about 88.
Yes. And I said to him, Matthew, that's the end. You shouldn't fight anyway. Coming off, he didn't lose. But, you know, he continued. I don't know who was putting him in. You can always get fights. He was an ex-champ and fought, you know, past it. But, boy, value for money, he was one of the most exciting fighters that ever lived. You know, him and Arturo Gatti, and he was better than Gatti, obviously. But I mean, those fights with Yaki Lopez and Marvin Johnson, and God, he was unbelievable. And it was incredible.
You'll know this well, because obviously you did a lot of work with Mickey Duff, didn't you?
I knew Mickey. Johnny was his agent, actually. So I did more with Barry Hearn than Mickey. But of course, I'm very good friends with Mickey.
Sure, because the first time I met Matthew, I was actually in the museum at Canastota looking at Matthew's plaque, and Mickey Duff was there. Mickey came over and he was saying to Matthew, "You used to beat all my guys," and he was referring to obviously Conti, Lottie Moali, and there was one or two others in there that Mickey threw at him.
No, he had no quit in him. He would just go forward. You know, he unfortunately met the perfect opponent, the buzzsaw with the Dwight Quawe, that just had the style. But I think Matthew had burned himself out. That style, it's amazing he lasted as long as he did. It's unfortunate he died, you know, too young, and his career went too long.
Yeah.
Great fighter at his peak.
Well, I mean, I remember saying to Dwight Quawe years ago, I said, you know, people said Matthew was shot when he fought you. And he said, I shot him.
Yeah. So he could say that, yeah. He fought a fighter, in fact, Elmer Boyce was, but Pete McIntyre in between those fights, and we provided McIntyre. He beat him, he stopped him. I think that style was always going to be difficult for him.
Yeah, Pete wound up as a sparring partner for Matthew after Matthew stopped him.
Yes, that's right. So they you know, somehow these connections happen, and then they were friendly until the demise of
Matthew. Sure. You mentioned King there. So what was it like working with Don King?
Well, you know, in the beginning, again, he was very idealistic. I met Don King the first time when Quarry and Ellis were supposed to fight a rematch in the Garden. and they had fought, and, you know, Quarry lost the decision. And Brenner, I used to hang around the Garden office. You know, osmosis, you pick up boxing. There was Duke Stefano and Teddy Brennan, John Condon, Harry Marks. And Brenner's office was sort of like a gathering place. You go from one, him, Duke Stefano was the assistant matchmaker. So they had a break, and they get Ernie Shavers to fight. Well, Ernie Shavers was under the command of Don Elbaum at the time, who was their advisor, which I've become. It means you're not the manager, you get a piece, but you don't have to invest. And he walks in tow, literally, was Don King. And he was like this giant dog on a leash. Here comes Elbaum, and here's Don King. And, you know, Don King, bombastic. He's quoting Aristotle and Shakespeare and Chaucer and whoever he could, whether it had all his malapropisms and whether it was relevant to the discussion, you know. And he was a tremendously colorful guy, and he's larger than, literally larger than life. You know, Brenner looks at him, wow, what's this? But great at a press conference, phenomenal. And sort of like, okay, and Brenner and he bond. Shavers knocks out Ellis in one round. And Brenner said, we're going to be together, Don, you, me, Shavers, this, all your fighters, you're the greatest. You know, everybody's wonderful when they're winning. Of course, Brenner had a great instance with Quarry. And then they make the rematch with Quarry. And he knocks out Shavers in one round. Big crowd. And after the fight, we're in the vestibule. You go out of the Garden. When you go to the dressing rooms, there's that, you know, hallway. In the dressing rooms, a little hallway. And King, everybody's talking Quarry and Brenner, Quarry and Foreman, $2 million will offer him this and that. And King is standing there. He says, what about Ernie Shavers? And Brenner was a very sarcastic and sagacious kind of a guy. But he turns to him and says, Ernie Shavers, who's Ernie Shavers? And that moment, you could see the look in King's eyes, like my look when I saw the Annapolis Lopez in the front row. It went like from admiration for the Brenner to, I wouldn't say hatred, but okay, I'll show you. And I swear that was his epiphany. That says, I'm going to stay in this business. I'm going to prove to you. And within months, he had taken over Foreman and Ali and was in the business in the commanding spot. And as you know, Foreman never fought Quarry. So that was his payback. But he also became the greatest promoter of a generation. And, you know, one of the greatest promoters of all time and debatably the greatest. But I saw that moment, I saw that look in his eyes, and boy, that changed it. And then I got a job with King through, at the time, I was friendly with Paddy Flood and Braverman. They got me in with King, and we started with him with the Chuck Wepner fight. But in the beginning, he wanted to sign all the fighters. I remember I brought a Monzon, Galindez, John Conti fought for us. We brought him in. I introduced him to Duran's people, to Arguello's people. But Paddy Flood and Braverman were, you know, they were interested in starting a tournament and getting kickbacks from, you know, guys like, you know, Chuck Wepner and inferior fighters, because they work with inferior fighters all their life. They couldn't think of it as a visionary. And so then I left King. But early he was, you know, he got in the business because he outpaid everybody else, just like Al Haymon did when he started and just like Eddie is doing now with, you know, the zone. And, you know, you initiate yourself by paying more than market prices. And he did. But then he made them turn a profit. And we did the, I remember we had Galindez against Ahumada and Lakata and Monzon, and then Ali and Bugner on the closed circuit in Madison Square Garden, and drew 18,000 people. So he wanted to be the greatest promoter in the world. That was his motivation. I think the business sours you, and then money, of course, became a motivation. But he wanted to do it, you know, it wasn't cutthroat with him. It was like, yes, let's get everybody. Let's sign everybody, I remember. Like a kid in a candy store.
Did you like him? Did you get on well with him?
We did early, and then I guess more to my fault. I mean, he's a giant, and I'm a midget, but you know, I sort of soured because his I left because Flood and Braverman had a dispute with me over an article I wrote about the Conti fight in with he boxed this kid Ray Elson in Scranton. And I put an article in the Ring magazine saying, showcasing John Conti in Scranton, which was a coal mining town, is like showcasing a diamond in a coal bin. Why did we put him here? You know, and they read the story, said, you'll never get it printed. They had this Johnny Ort who was their buddy. He'll stop it. I says, no, because I was a buddy of Dan Daniel, who was the boss at the time. He was 85. He was with Fleischer when they started the magazine, and he had a big foghorn voice, and he saw the story. I said, they won't print it. Oh, won't print it. I said, I was told I can't get it printed. They said, is it the truth? I said, yes. All right. So he calls John Orton. He says, print it. He said, but, print it. And we did, and then they had a falling out, and I left. King says, come on back. I hired you, not them. You're working for me. I said, no, you got to fire them. So, well, I'm not firing them and I'm not firing you. So if you want to come back with them, you can. If you don't, you know, I'm not firing them. But I'm telling you, you can come back. And I didn't, and then went out on my own. And then King and I clashed, and again, bitterness towards me. But I he can be a great person. He can be a very difficult person. But I would say every business deal I've ever had with him, he's been 100% correct, always.
You were in Zaire for the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yes, I was. And
it's not a bad night to have been a witness at?
No, I was going to school then in college, and I had a job, one of the rare jobs I ever had. They got me to work in a cafeteria in the Yankee Stadium as a cashier. And I remember what had happened is I was very friendly. Again, I knew everybody from Mexico at the time. And there's a newspaper that's still published, a daily sports paper, Esto, which is the equivalent of Equipe, you know, but they did boxing and football, but boxing, a lot of boxing. So when the fight was originally scheduled, crazy kind of deal, they were flying people to Iceland. I don't know what, Reykjavik. I think it was Iceland Airlines or something like that. And they went from New York, Reykjavik, and then into Zaire. And then Foreman got cut and the fight was postponed. So the Mexicans were going to go. They had their tickets. They came to New York and they found the postponement. So I got a call from my friend Rafael Mendoza. He said, you want to go to Zaire? I said, what? Yeah, you want to do the fight? I said, are you kidding? Well, you know, we spent money last time and the tickets, they can't get them back. He said, we still have the tickets from New York to Zaire. One ticket. We're going to send a photographer, but we'll use the APUP. I said, I'll do it. So I walked into that cafeteria. I said, I can't come tomorrow. I said, why? I said, well, I'm going to Africa. They looked at me like, what? Yes, I'm stopping the $3 and I'm going to Africa. All right. So I got on the thing and I went. They took me and went to Zaire, and it was quite an experience. You know, it's everybody tried to rip you off over there because you get off. You lose your luggage for $20. You'd find it again. They lose the hotel for $20. They'd find it again. Everything was with their handout. But the fight was an amazing event. I remember going there. And there was a tremendous rain. It was just, you know, the threat of rain was there. Keep the thunder in the distance. And if you've been to Africa, you know, thunder in Africa is like nowhere else. And rain in Africa is like nowhere else. And this is central Congo. And so in Kinshasa, and this, oh, it's going to rain. So they got the Ali fight in. And of course, he wins. And again, the funny things that you remember that stand out, like Gene Kelly coming down the elevator with Ali Frazier. There was a fighter, Roy Williams. I never could get a fight. He was a sparring partner. He knew me from Philly and said, oh, Don, you're here. Very surprised. And he was fighting
Roy
Henry
Tiger
Clark.
Williams, right? Roy Tiger Williams.
Roy Tiger Williams. Yeah. And he was going to fight Henry Clark. He said, you know, I'm on this card. He was so thrilled. It's like when Larry O'Connell got the assignment. He was so thrilled. And his eyes are bright. I'm going to fight. So they kept postponing and they wanted to get the fight in early because of the rain, impending rain. So you hear the rain clouds and little drops coming down after they get out and then forming out of the ring. And Williams is there gloved up, and Clark is there gloved up. And you see Williams, boy, this is my chance. And right before they can introduce them, all of a sudden, kaboom, like a bomb went off. And this rain comes down in a torrent. It was like you're standing on a Niagara Falls. And I looked at the face of Roy Williams and the disappointment in the guy's eyes. I said, oh, my God. He said, I came thousands of miles, spent weeks in training, and I'm in the ring, and I still can't fight.
Oh, geez. What was it like? Could you believe what was going on in front of your eyes when Ali was standing up to Foreman's punishment?
Well, there was another thing where I've always predicted wrong with Ali. I mean, but then I became a great admirer. Of course, he's the greatest heavyweight of all time. No, again, everybody there was writing. It was sort of like Hagler Leonard that, you know, not only was Ali going to lose, he might get killed because you had Foreman come in with ferocity. He had knocked out Frazier, knocked him down six times. He destroyed Ken Norton, who went the limit and beat Ali in the one fight. And in between, you know, okay, Joe Rome, but it was a one-round blitz. So this guy was a juggernaut. He was like a railroad train. And Ali, you know, was not looking the greatest. He came off the Norton fights. The second fight was close. And the Frazier fight, he had beaten him on decision in the rematch. But, I mean, it's just his form. And as I said, this is List in the 24. He's going to be champ like Joe Lewis for a decade. And, you know, the theory is that Ali's plan is the first round, Ali won, you know, and he sort of set the tone. I always say the first round's the most important. And you could see he took form by surprise. But as the second and third round came, he started doing the rope-a-dope. Now, I don't know if that was intentional or the way Foreman was fighting, because if you looked at it, I remember writing at the time, Foreman's just chugging away and he's belting out and throwing. Ali would have these flashes where he left, right, left and hit him in the head. But Foreman, I thought, was winning. I mean, he had him in the corner. And as you could see, it was hot. And again, the humidity, I said, the rain pending. And you could see Foreman slowly, like a big inflatable doll, just the air going out of him. And the third round is a little slower, and the fourth round a little slower, and the punch is a little slower in the fifth round. And you just see him wearing out, and Ali just stood up. You know, people forget, because he was a great boxer and such hand speed and so light on his feet, that he had tremendous ability to take a punch. He was only stopped that one time, and he fought the great punches, Shavis, Williams, Foreman, Frazier, Liston, and stood up. And so he outlasted him. And then at the end, it was like a storybook finish, you know, just amazing. And the Ali Boumaye with the people in the stands yelling at after the fight. Incredible.
Let me play some word association with you. I chuck some names at you and you can tell me some, either tell me an anecdote or what springs to mind.
All right, try to keep it quick.
Chris Dundee.
Wonderful guy, very well knowledgeable guy. Old school, live by his word. You didn't need a contract with Chris Dundee.
Angelo.
A fabulous, probably one of the best. I wrote a story once about the five best liked people that nobody can say anything against. He, Hank Kaplan, John Wischhausen. One of the most beloved figures in boxing history and a very, very nice, wonderful man, too.
Hank Kaplan was a great guy, by the way.
Oh.
Did you ever do anything with Hank and James Scott?
No, I didn't. I worked with Hank when we were on the board at the steering committee. He, Herb Goldman, and I for the Boxing Hall of Fame. And then we became great friends. He was friendly with Frank Maloney. We went in England. Frank would have him come over all the Lennox Lewis fights. A beautiful human being, a saintly human being, I guess, as close as you can say.
Bill Caton.
Bill Caton, yeah, shrewd businessman, ooh, cold fish boy. He lost Mike Tyson because I remember one time I was in the office to buy some films for a guy in Europe, and they get a ring from the secretary, said, Mike is here, like, Mike who? Mike Tyson. Well, tell him to wait. And I'm saying, here's Mike Tyson. Yeah, like, he was the number one contender at that. Wait, and he was sitting down there reading a magazine. You just shook your head on the way out, but boy, was he a cold fish, yeah.
Wow. Teddy Brenner.
Oh, you know, I was friendly with him, and then he became against me when I got involved with a court case he had against Jose Suleiman. Brilliant, the greatest matchmaker that ever lived. Not the nicest guy in the world, but he was great with fighters. He was, he'd give you an honest day's work for an honest day's living. He would put you in a fight that you had a chance to win, and people would accuse him of knocking guys off, but he never really overmatched somebody, but he just felt you had to earn a living. But a good guy, a good person, and tough to deal with, but a good guy.
Mike Tyson.
I don't know Mike that well, a great fighter. Obviously, he's been very nice. I mean, a very bright individual, very intelligent guy, and a real icon. You can see what he did with Roy Jones. He's probably the last great icon in boxing.
Eileen Eaton.
Oh, she's a dragon lady. She didn't like me because I was so close. I love George Parnassus, and I would like, she accused me of being George Parnassus' PR man, you know. I says, well, I don't know, but she was another very tough to deal with. I never had a little business with her. Very shrewd, very smart. Again, she was, real tough. She had scorpion blood in her veins.
Mike Jacobs.
Mike Jacobs, I never met. Jim Jacobs or Mike Jacobs? Mike Jacobs was the promoter.
Well, let's go both. You know, Jim's actually next on the list. So
Mike Jacobs was George Parnassus' idol. He loved the guy. He helped him out with Seferino Garcia. I've heard good things and bad things about him. Erwin Rosie was married to his daughter or his niece. He would tell me stories about Jacobs, but obviously one of the great, great promoters of all time. You know, he changed the business. Joe Louis, Henry Armstrong, Robinson, he started all of them out. The Garden, the big shows, a wonderful, great promoter. Jim Jacobs, again, another strange kind of a guy, another cold fish. That must have been a very interesting association, him and Bill Caton. It's like two ice cubes in doing business. Yeah.
Did you ever meet Cuss, by the way, Cuss D'Amato?
I did. Brilliant. Cuss is a guy, you never got a conversation with him, you got a lecture. You say, hi, Cuss. Well, let me tell you about this. But a genius. I mean, truly a genius. Everybody called him crazy, but boy, he was brilliant. He changed the face of boxing. Look at the money he made for Patterson. You know, you change, go from Ezra Charles to Patterson, which is less than a decade. Patterson made millions. Charles made tens of thousands. He knew how to exploit the closed circuit business. And everybody said he was completely mobbed up as well, which was probably interesting because he was the greatest manager and the greatest trainer, but he wound up broke. So how did that happen? You know, obviously he had a very small percentage of these fighters, but a totally brilliant guy. Crazy too, but brilliant guy.
You mentioned Seferino Garcia. Wasn't he Sinatra's boy for a while?
I don't know about Sinatra and him. He was a Filipino, came to America. So I don't know. It may have been, you know, George Parnassus was like the kind of guy that snapped. He knew everybody. So he certainly would have known Sinatra if he had invested in the fight.
Russell Peltz.
A wonderful person. The last of the great grassroots promoters. I mean, he would take a fighter. He took Tyrone Everett from a four-round fighter to draw 18,000 people with Alfredo Escalera. He took two fighters, Cyclone Hart and Willie Monroe, and they drew 18,000 people in a 10-round fight in Philadelphia. A great, great idealist, wonderful, a wonderful human being, and one of the greatest promoters that ever lived. Fantastic person.
Harold Smith.
I never had to do business with these guys. For whatever reason, I met him with a fellow named Norman Henry, and he had a partner who ran the Wells Fargo Bank or was a managing director. I forget his name. And when he introduced me, I said, gee, where'd you get these this money from? Did you rob a bank? And the look on the guy's face was like, so that's how naive I am. And then it came out like, and ever since, I never took my phone calls to put a fighter in. But fortunately, I was saved from that. So I never got involved with the chicanery.
Well, you say you were saved from it. I mean, there was only really chicanery with that big garden bill at the end.
Yeah.
Everything else went ahead, didn't it?
Well, you know, he was doing shows over, but when he came to New York, now again, he was a challenge to the garden. He was in, Don King was in New York at the time. Bob Arum was based there. So now he was taking on really the major leaguers, you know, the top guys. And the New York reporters, as you know, the tabloid people at the time, he had Michael Katz and Mike Marley, and they were going to dig into stuff. And they finally kept digging into this situation, and they found out what was going on. So the whole thing exploded or imploded at that point, right before he had that big night of boxing with Cooney and Norton and Saad, I guess, was going to fight Mustafa and Tony Ayala. It was a great boxing show. Unfortunately, he was paying such inflated prices, they couldn't do it. They ended up doing Cooney and Norton as one of the fights.
Well, it would have been interesting because obviously that was all the money. If you're playing poker, everything was on that hand.
Yes.
They never got to play that hand.
That's it. If he had been successful, he probably would have gone on, you know, because he probably would have made profit enough to continue without, maybe he would have paid back the loans and everything else and would have walked away. But it just hit, and that was the end of that. I guess he tried to stay in boxing to some degree afterwards. Some people said they heard from him or spoken to him. I, as I said, never had any relationship with the guy at all.
You mentioned Luis Rodriguez going back. What did you think of Luis?
Well, I didn't know him very well. I met him once, but a great, great fighter. You know, he and Griffith fought the five times. Four times that Griffith won was split decisions. The only unanimous decision was the fight that Rodriguez won in California under Parnassus. Terrific, terrific fight. I don't think he's in the Hall of Fame, but he doesn't get the kind of recognition that he deserves. He's just a notch below Emil Griffith, but a terrific, great fighter, great middleweight, great welterweight. Yeah.
Because we just talked obviously there about Hank. I remember Hank actually helped me when I was traveling around on the buses in America. He set up an interview for me with Florentino Fernandez.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
great. And he set up a translator for me as well. So he managed to, in one afternoon, he managed to get me a translator who managed to pick me up from the bus stop, take me to Fernandez's house,
Wow. Do
the interview with Florentino, and then get me back on the bus. Which was
You know, they were saying what they said, you know, that he's in the Hall of Fame, but they were a Hall of Fame for great human beings. He would be in that as well. He was just one of the most universally liked. You couldn't have, I never met a man that Hank Kaplan didn't like, and I never met a person that didn't like Hank Kaplan.
Yeah. You also worked with Jeff Harding, didn't you?
Yes, I managed him. We ended up poorly, but he was, tremendous heart. That's another story when he won the title. You know, he had fought. I worked with Bill Morty. That was another great promoter, a great friend. And he had started Jeff Fennec, and then he later got in with Costa Zoo, and Bugner came over there. We had him. And Harding was there. You know, he was coming up. He was never clicked like Fennec. He was a great, exciting fighter. But by that time, we didn't have network TV in Australia, so he would have been developed on pay-per-view, so a smaller audience. But he fought a kid, Nestor Giovannini, and it was not a good fight. And we put him in the super middleweight division. And I remember calling Jose Suleiman. He approved the fight. It was going to be Leonard and Lalonde, I guess. And I said, well, you should have given that fight to Harding. We're yelling and screaming. He said, just wait. I said, what do you mean wait? He dropped out of the ratings. So apparently after the fight, what happened? We had a fight coming up. That was it. We were going to fight for the super middleweight title. It's after Leonard with a vacant title. And Lalonde had lost. And then he came back to fight for the title against Dennis Andres. And Suleiman had taken Harding out of the ratings and put him in the light heavyweight ratings. I was fighting. Why is he in there? So just wait. Well, he knew that Lalonde was going to quit. So he says, you can fight for the title with Dennis Andres. So he had gone to his office with Bill Moore to get paid for the Giovannini fight. And I called Bill. I said, what's happening with Harding? He says, I told him to give it up. He looked terrible. He lost money on the show. He hasn't got it. So, well, you better tell him to get back in the ring. I got a light heavyweight title fight. And so help me. Puts down the phone. I hear him go out the window. Jeff, come back up to the office. Come back up here. Comes up. He accepts the fight. The trainer, Johnny Lewis, we couldn't convince him. So, he's not ready. I spent 2 hours on the phone to Australia. I have the bill around here somewhere. And convincing him, take the fight. So we came in to take the fight. He was a dead underdog. Andres was trained by Emmanuel Stewart. And again, another great night of boxing in my life. And I remember there was a baseball strike. So it was our boxing on TV. There were two shows a day going out. And in the audience at a baseball convention, my dad's idol was Joe DiMaggio, but I never met my dad, so that's why I didn't get involved in sports. And in the arena, we had DiMaggio, Pete Rose, and Ted Williams sitting at ringside watching a fight. Saad was there, Saad Muhammad, Mike Tyson, It was incredible. I said, here's a guy who goes from total obscurity. And he's taking it. So I like the Paul. He's taking a beating, taking it. And everybody's, Eduardo Lamazon was a supervisor. He put Harding in the rings and he got knocked down. And Eduardo looked like, look what you did to me. I said, no, no, wait. And he's, we think he's going to lose. He comes back. He knocks Andres out in an incredible fight. And after the fight in the dressing room, but most memorable again to me, it's always the sideline. Donald Trump, it was in his hotel. And he said to me, may I shake hands with the champ? I said, sure, Mr. Trump, come on right in. And he said, I want to congratulate you. I said, oh, wow, there he's shaking hands with Donald. We don't have a picture of that. But that I remember. And he came again from nowhere to winning that title. So it was an amazing night, phenomenal night.
Okay, I've got a couple more for you, Don, then I'll let you go. But I definitely want to pick this up like in person when I could travel again. I want to come and see
you. Yeah, we'll get together for a nice meal somewhere when they finally open the city up.
But we've talked about Angelo there. You talked about Johnny Lewis, who was the great Australian trainer.
Yes.
Tell me about some of the great trainers that you've seen and respect, because obviously you go back beyond to Arcel and that lot.
Ray Arcel, but there's another great gentleman of the ring. Everybody loved Ray Arcel. He was another cerebral guy. He was not an ex-fighter. You know, he looked at it analytically. Him, of course, Freddie Brown, who just got into the Boxing Hall of Fame this year. He was a terrific trainer. My good friend Billy Edwards, who handled Bob Foster and Camel and Holly Mims. Gil Clancy, you know, worked with Emil Griffith all his career. Angelo, Emmanuel Stewart, you know, great trainer. Yvonne Michel, who's now a promoter, was a terrific trainer up in Canada. Over the years, other guys I've met, you have to pick my memory here.
Teddy Atlas, Emmanuel Stewart?
Yeah, Emmanuel Stewart, a great trainer and became a manager and promoter. No, sensational, wonderful trainer, one of the best. Yeah, Teddy Atlas, and then he was a protege of obviously Customato and had worked with him. There's other Billy Giles in New York now is an excellent trainer. I like Ian Alcock over there. He's another personality. He's a good trainer. Some of them don't get the recognition they deserve because they haven't had the limelight. Jackie McCoy, another great trainer, manager. You know, a lot of in those days they were trainers and manager and cut men. You know, you have one guy would show up with a fight and not a retinue of six or seven people yet.
Sure.
And I never met Charlie Goldman, obviously. Johnny Boz knew him and liked him, and he liked Boz. I never met Blackburn. He died before my time. I met Teddy Bentham and guys like that. I was probably closer to the managers, but a number of those trainers were, you know, Kid Rapidez had Napolis. I remember him quite well. And as you had mentioned, Angelo Dundee. I knew, Goody Petronelli and a lot of these guys out of Philadelphia and things like that.
And then one thing I'd like you to say, and I'll make the question long so you can start thinking about it. We hear the stereotype of fighters getting ripped off by managers and promoters and all the rest of it. You must have seen your fair share of fast moves by guys. In fact, I was just reading, someone was telling me about this fight the other day. In fact, it was a fight back in the 90s where a fighter was told, oh, the purse is going down week by week, saying they're running out of money. They go over and take the fight. And next thing you know, the fighter's watching the manager arguing with a couple of people. And the manager's saying, look, you get on the flight home. I'm going to try and get the money. I'm going to stay out here and try and get the money out of them. Mm-hmm. Whether the manager got the money out of them or not, the fighter didn't get paid.
Yeah.
The manager might well have got his pay. He might have even taken the fighter's pay as well and then got very rich off the trip. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of horror stories like that? And without necessarily naming names, although by all means do if you want to. Mm-hmm. Tell me a story.
I'll tell you, I've been in situations where the promoter didn't make, I was telling someone the other day in Colombia where the promoter didn't make money and the guy was going out the window of the hotel with a suitcase to stiff the hotel owner and the fighters and everything else. There've been notorious stories where people got bad checks from promoters and they bounced. And I'm certain there are situations with promoters. I mean, today you've got the promotional rights situation. What is that? A promoter promotes a guy, and to me, a promoter is supposed to stage the fights. Now they make a deal with another promoter. And one of the great problems we have in the United States, and I don't know how it works in England, because you can be a manager promoter there, is if I'm a manager, I sign a contract. Now it's 33%. You rarely get that today. In fact, you invest so much money. Got a kid fighting in Philadelphia four rounds. I'll make no money. The kid has to sell tickets to get on the card. And at the end of the tickets he sells, he pays for the opponent, or the manager pays the opponent out of pocket. So you have a lot more deals of managers getting ripped off today than fighters, but certainly it happened. You have a situation where you know, a lot of these promoters, there's no restriction on how much a promoter can take. So if I'm a promoter and a fighter gets $100,000, I can legally say, well, your end is 50. I make a deal with a bigger promoter, say a Top Rank or a Match Room. They pay me 100. I pay the fighter 50. Out of that 50, the fighter has to pay his management. Whereas a manager, I can sign for 33%. If I say, oh, my end is $30,000 on $100,000, and I say to a promoter, give me $10,000 under the table, I can and should rightly go to jail or be prosecuted for it. But a promoter can set any amount of money for a profit he wants. You can't legislate a profit. So he says, the fighter gets 100, I want 200. And there's no accounting. The commissions need to have a contract for promoters and fighters like they do for managers and fighters that said, if the promoter transfers the rights to another promoter, he's entitled to 20% of the gross maximum, not arbitrarily any amount of money that he can take. And that's one of the biggest problems happening in boxing today. These minor league promoters are ostensibly managers. They promote the fight till they get them hooked up with one of the major TV promoters, and there are only about four in the country. And then they're entitled to charge whatever they want. And that's a bad situation today. I've seen more of that. I see most managers going broke. I mean, I've invested $30,000, $40,000 in fighters and not gotten the money back because you have to subsidize them early. They won't put you on a show. You have to sell tickets and pay for your own fight. You have to pay what they call a slot fee now to even get on a show. So a manager can be stuck $20,000 with an ordinary fighter before he even sees a 10-round fight. And then when he tries to get his money back, then say, oh, you're stealing from the fighter. So, well, what about the $50,000 I invested? Do I get that back off the 100? It looks like they're stealing, but they're not. But have guys gotten ripped off? Yes. When Wepner was fighting Ali, I remember we were going over, he was sitting there with a sheet, and Al Braben was his manager. And he says, we need to rent the car out. Okay, he was getting $100,000. Don't worry, take it off the top. Well, the sparring partner needs $200. We got to buy equipment. Go, take it off the top. He said, well, we need to just take it off the top. And Al says, I need to go to New York. I need to stay in a hotel. I'll take it off the top. So Wepner finally looks up from the sheet with 100 minus this, minus that. He says, Al, there ain't no more top. We're at the bottom. He says, there's nothing here. Off the top, off the top, off the top. We're down to about $9,000. Ain't no more top. But yes, of course it's happened. And it's happened to me. It's happened to people. But I think in today's market, you see more of the manager. The manager now is a guy who just puts up money for a fighter and subsidizes him till he hooks up with a promoter. But the great problem I see is no restriction on the amount of money a promoter can charge to make in transferring the rights to another promoter.
Got you. Okay, Don. Well, look, I'm really grateful for your time. It's been brilliant.
Brilliant to meet you. We'll see face to face. All our restaurants are opening up here in New York. I don't know the rest of the country, but what is the story with international travel now between the UK and here and us going over there?
We can't go there, that's for sure, unless it's work. So, but you know, there's a good chance I might be over there researching the Saad Mohammed book. So I'm gonna.
Oh, great. I'll probably. Well, have you talked to Russell about him?
I speak to Russell quite a lot. Yes.
He is a wonderful guy and a bright guy, and he can give you a terrific story, great anecdote, you know, great raconteur, and can tell a story. He's doing a book, by the way.
I was just going to say, as good as I hope my book's going to be, I don't think it's going to hold a candle to Russell's, which is probably one of the best books that can be written, Russell's book.
Yeah, yes, he's got great experiences, and he's known, you know, the transition from old business to new business. And again, he's a purist. He loved boxing before he, you know, got into the business of boxing. So he comes from the heart as well as from the head.
Yeah, for sure. Brilliant, Don. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm grateful. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you, Tris. Sorry for all the technical problems hooking up, but I appreciate the time. Talk to you soon. See you soon. Looking forward to it.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, I was going to say that was about perfect from Don, but to be frank, we could have gone on all day. We didn't touch upon numerous things. He was very involved with Lennox Lewis. He was very involved with Carl Froch for a while, getting the fights and matches over in the US. And we could have gone on and on. You could see that there were sort of different rabbit holes that we did vanish down through those 90 minutes. But one of the fastest podcasts I think I've ever recorded. That was an absolute privilege to do with Don. So many great stories and so many great memories. Before I leave you this week, I just want to remind you, we are brought to you by Hansenly Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Please give us a follow at Boxing Life Stories on Facebook and on Instagram. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tris Dixon. And on Patreon, you can get early access to upcoming episodes, including one with big heavyweight, big horrible heavyweight, certainly not horrible, but that's what people called him back in the day. But Big David Price is already up on Patreon, and that will be a future episode out soon. In the meantime, guys, I hope you're all well and staying safe, and I'll be back next week.